The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
Parenting is so hard and so emotionally challenging that by the time your child is 13, there's two things that go on to make that a difficult time. Basically, whatever age your child is, the feelings from that age in your childhood are what's coming up. And most of us had some misery in our adolescence. And so your child becomes an adolescent. They're not cute. They're growing hair in places they didn't have hair before. And we sort of back off and we get reminded of the miseries that came up for us when our parents backed away from us because we were reminding them of their even more miserable childhood. The second thing is that parents have been through 12 years of parenting with such poor support. You're tired and you just wish they were grown and gone already. And you don't want to wish that, and you don't even let yourself know you're wishing that, but in there, you need some respite, and there is no respite.
It's a wonderful chaos, beautifully random, messy and glorious,
solo or tandem.
You work to find rest, and fight to find peace, both head and the heart,
like it left you and me.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way.
Here we go. We are live, Bambos. Cheers.
Cheers.
A wonderful chaos.
Wonderful chaos indeed.
Today, Bambos, this is a fun show.
Patsy Whipfer.
Whiffler.
Whiffler.
It took me a while to do that as well. Whiffler. And I waited to get Patty on because I didn't want to invite her on until we got over like 100 shows because I wanted to make sure that we had some level of professionalism before we actually engaged someone in this realm of parenthood that I thought was so important a subject. And we're going to talk to Patty about 30 years helping and supporting parents to raise their children. And we're going to do that on
A Wonderful
Chaos. So like I mentioned, Patty and I, we've had contact for, I believe, 5 years now. I met her at one of the most absurd conferences I've ever been to in my life. It was probably 2 weeks before my mentor Case died. And we all came together in Tennessee. And it was a weird conference where each one of us had the opportunity to tell everyone else how they should live their lives. And I think Patty was the only intelligent one because she just looked at the whole thing and said, I'm just going to stay quiet in the corner because there's nothing to gain here. So I've only gained more respect for her over the years, having had that experience with her. She knew how to navigate several people coming together that thought that what they had to say was important. I use a lot of her stuff, actually.
Yeah, I got that yesterday when you mentioned it.
What I find fascinating is I use a lot of her stuff, although I've never formally done any of the programs because they make so much sense that it, in some ways it's very intuitive. Mm. Of course, the program's important, but for me, it was like, oh, and I think that the
I'd like to have an example.
I was going
to
say we'll ask for an example, but one of these tools that I see, it's sort of humorous. It's called, and I might not even be explaining it well, but let me do my best. It's called Stay Listening, and it's really being present for another's emotions so that they can let the emotions out without anything obstructing that at all. Mm. And in an adult form, it looks a bit different than in a child form. A child form, in some ways, I've lived and spent time with a family that does this practice, and they'll actually incite the children to have an emotional out. And then the child emotes because they have all of this tension inside of themselves from whatever their daily experience has been to that moment. And then the parents will hold them actually while a child is vibrating and angry. And it's this loving embrace in that moment when the child can't integrate their emotions that gives the child the opportunity to feel safe and comfortable to the point where it passes through them. And it's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde. You know, they just turn back into the child that they once were because they got that emotion out of their system. And what I thought was funny is that as, you know, as we age, we realize that even if someone looks like an adult, sometimes they behave like children. And the weird thing is yeah, that
I hear you say that. Like you're talking to the 13-year-old
yeah,
right now.
I'll talk to the 13-year-old version of that person or the 16 because it doesn't make sense to try to reach them in any other way. But what I also found through Patty's tools is actually all you're doing is you're doing the same sort of stay listening only with an adult. And of course, you might not embrace them because that might not be acceptable, but you'll sort of be there with them and say, hey, I know it's hard. What's going on? And then you let them go through all of their emotional states.
Do it now. Let's see.
Vamos. I know it's been hard.
It's really hard, Andy.
What's going on? It must be terrible. Like almost accelerate the terrible. You're having the worst time, Vamos.
Worst time, Andy.
Yeah. And somehow letting it go frees you up again. So that's
well, been... jokes aside, you have used this technique with me in the past when you've mentored me.
Yeah.
And I mean, the crying felt ancient.
Mm.
It felt like it was coming from a very far place.
Yeah.
Which even shocked me.
Yeah. So you can thank Patty for that.
Thank you, Patty. shall we bring her on?
I say we bring her on. Yeah, let's bring her on. There she is.
I love your glasses and I love the plant behind you.
It got too wild for the bathroom, so I brought it in.
Oh, really?
We went for Star Wars again.
Yeah, we love having abstract imagery to kind of make fun and light of talks that could otherwise be serious.
Good. Well, hello. It's good to be with you both.
Do you need to correct anything that I began with?
You know, you don't always hold a child while they're really upset. Sometimes it's, you know, you have to really feel that one, figure it out as to what's best. But I guess the way I like to explain it is that while a child is pouring out, you know, their big feelings, you're pouring in your confidence that they are a good person, your confidence that the crying or tantrums or whatever it is that they're doing to show you this big emotion, confidence that that is exactly what they need to do, that their mind has chosen the right thing for the right moment because they weren't functioning well before. So it's like just having a big cry locked in your room because your parents don't want to be bothered with it is not healing. But having a big cry while someone protects you and has faith in you and kind of anchors you through a big emotional experience, that is deeply healing because there's space in the emotional mind where all of that stuff was being managed and held, and it's a lot of work to do that. And once all of those feelings are out, then the reassurance and the caring kind of goes clunk and it falls into place and a child feels so much closer to you. Yeah. And I guess the other thing is that there was a woman who advocated this process, but the way she advocated it was, you know, every afternoon at 3:00, a parent holds their child and says, no, you can't do anything else. And that incites a lot of crying.
Yeah.
And we do not do that. It's not, it's basically when you see your child is full of tension, they're going to be behaving in ways that don't make any sense. And so what you need to do is in order to make things safe enough for them to release whatever is driving all of that, you know, the aggression or the balkiness or the refusal to do homework or whatever, you know, you move in and you set a limit without blame. And that will trigger, it's like, so you set the necessary limit to keep things safe and sane. And if they have feelings, they will spill them out. You know, if you shame them or blame them or scold them, it complicates the process and sort of basically there's no listener there if you're full of upset towards your child. But that's the idea of stay listening.
That I'd love to talk a little bit about that and touch on something else you jumped over. The first thing was that it just dawned on me that I, of course, when one sees the video, when a parent might shame their children when they're emoting, mm-hmm. like that's when I felt my stomach sink as you were speaking, because what I was hearing were the consequences of not embracing the emotional state of the child when they are emoting.
Yeah.
I haven't really thought about it, but I mean, I can say, I know we're speculating. What do you see happening in a child who's emoting and then not only not being seen, but even maybe being shamed? What's the consequence?
Oh, we've all experienced those consequences many, many times.
Yeah.
I mean, that is that, you know, the ordinary childhood experience is you trying to get feelings off your chest and your parents go nuts, or that your teacher goes nuts, or the neighbor goes nuts. It adds hurt onto the hurt that you were trying to heal from. On the other hand, it's really, really hard because no one ever listened to us to actually do stay listening to your child. It's like once they start, you know, telling you you're a bad daddy, or you don't let me, because part of, you know, children having a dim view of us is part of the process of getting bad feelings out, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes. And when a parent sees behavior that was never allowed for them, they get triggered. And when you can't think, when emotions have flooded you, then what you do is you hop into ruts that were made for you by, you know, the patterns in your family during your childhood. And so you'll call your kid a little brat, you know, just the way you were called a little brat. You'll do it with a little less vehemence and a little, you know, not as often as it was done to you.
Yeah.
Because parents really do surmount the obstacles that they met when they were children, at least partially, but you can't climb out of it by yourself entirely.
I remember in my childhood, my dad would often yell at me. Mm-hmm. And when I would cry, he'd shame me all the time. Yeah. And he'd often say that my tears were used to manipulate him.
Yeah.
Because obviously he felt that it was hard for him to see me cry instead of feeling any of the pain. So as you speak, I'm reminded of those moments when that occurred in my own life. I also saw Bambos was getting emotional as you were speaking. So I was actually wondering what was going on in you as you were hearing Patty just now.
Oh, so much. My childhood, similar to yours. And I also sometimes I'll see a baby in a carriage and I'll see the parent being incapable actually in dealing with it. And it's more like trying to silence the baby, like we're talking about not even a year old, putting a dummy, feeding, anything, just stop crying. And I see it playing out. And yeah, it hurts my internal organs.
Mm. Yeah. And there's a lot, you know, I mean, even babies have a lot to recover from. It's not easy getting out of the womb and into the world. It's really a long, a mysterious and frightening trip. And by the time they get out, they do need to have some cries about, you know,
I'm sure the 9 months of being in the belly also had a lot happening.
Yeah.
And they've shown that there was an experiment done or some research done on women who were pregnant in Manhattan during when 9/11 happened. And they checked their babies compared to the babies born during that period of time who were not in Manhattan at that time. And the babies who were in Manhattan at that time were, I think, 3 times more likely to have the symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome as infants. You know, they would just startle and basically we're much more scared. It's harder for them to sleep. It's harder for them to, you know, to relax because the fear hormones do pass through the placenta into a developing child. So and babies that I've worked with who just, you know, they couldn't sleep for more than 40 minutes ever. And it was just, you know, insanity for their parents to try to even get any sleep themselves because their baby was awake every half hour from night and day. And, you know, those are babies of parents, moms who we're just under a lot of stress during pregnancy and all of that. It's like the baby doesn't know why they're scared. There's no picture. There's no incident. There's no nothing there, but they just feel threatened, you know, constantly. And so it, you know, and, you know, the baby I'm thinking of in particular, whose mother was spending, you know, 10 hours a day trying to put the baby to sleep, you know, in a dark room, rocking, you know, going absolutely nuts. Mm. Like once she started listening to her baby cry and just going, sweetie, I'm right here. Mm. You're safe. Whatever happened, it's over. And I'm here. I'll take care of you. And letting her baby cry and cry and cry and receive that kind of warmth and confidence. Mm. It's like that baby within 3 weeks was sleeping 2 and 3 hours long, which is still not long enough, but a huge improvement over waking up every 40 minutes. Mm.
I have a weird question. When I was a child, like I don't even know, maybe from 7 to 10 or 11, I would bump my head to go to sleep.
Interesting.
Like, huh? I'd bump my head against the pillow, like as a repetitious act. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've never really given it much thought. I mean, I remember having done it, but I didn't have any association with it. Obviously, you've been supporting so many parents. Is this something you know of? And is there something that I could diagnose myself with in retrospect?
I think when children go to sleep, is the time when the fears, basically we all carry some fear. Some of us carry mountains of it and some of us carry, you know, bits here and there. But the fears that we carry are hard to manage. And one of the ways that we manage carrying fear is either to zone out, you know, suck our thumbs, twist our hair, you know, do little repetitive things to keep our body in motion, to keep our mind distracted from having any feelings. It might be that's what was happening. Basically, and when you're getting ready to go to sleep, you're not active anymore. You're not seeing things, doing things, talking to people. And that means that you're going to begin feeling the feelings that are hard to keep down. And so my guess is that you were, you know, there was some fear there. You didn't feel reassured. Nobody was really listening to how you felt at all, or even thought, oh, my child might have feelings. Maybe I should find out what they are. That's not a thought in parenting.
I think about it, there was a lot of the house. Obviously, my parents got divorced in that period. Mm-hmm. So clearly the stress of all of that would have permeated everything in my being without a doubt. So,
That would be the location of what was going on for you probably. And it was, you know, it was a useful tactic. It's like, how are you going to get to sleep if you've got fears rumbling? So you just distract yourself. Yeah. That's how you did it. Yeah. So smart, Andy.
Nice.
Very smart, Andy.
Too bad that you had to do that.
In my life, I always look at the person where they are and how they're talking. And then I always get curious about their childhood. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if it's okay to go there, by the way.
Sure, of course.
In what kind of environment were you raised?
My parents had me in 1946, so right after the war. And my dad was just back from England in the war. They were fairly young. I'm the oldest of six children. We're a Catholic family. So, you know, there's 14 years between me and my youngest brother.
Wow.
Really good people, earnest people, hardworking people. And I think the main thing that really got me, I don't know, it feels like the root of why I do this work with parents and ultimately to try to better the lives of both parents and children, was because I had a brother 18 months younger than me, and my mom had another a girl when I was four, so she had three children, four and under, pretty quickly. And my sister was just this beautiful little baby who I felt really attached to and close to. My mom had told me how, you know, I was going to be a big sister. I was going to get to take care of her. I was going to get to help her take care. I was like into the idea that I was her sister and I was her protector. And when she was about 7 months old, she began losing developmental skills. She couldn't sit anymore. And she began having a hard time just sucking on a bottle for more than 3 ounces. She just get tired and quit. And so she was getting hard to feed, and no doctors knew what was going on. Something, we still don't know what happened to her, but somehow her whole brain disintegrated. And over a period of about a year, she became unable to move voluntarily, unable to, very hard time feeding her because she didn't have enough coordination or strength or something to stay with getting fed. And eventually she didn't recognize us at all. And mm-hmm. and then my mom kind of collapsed from the work and the stress of not being able to save her baby. And so she was sent to a nursing home, first to a hospital, then a nursing home. She spent the rest of her life in a state hospital for the developmentally disabled in California, and died when she was 9.
And this happened when you were?
I was 4.
You were 4 at that time. So in that way, you had a very visceral memory of that moment. Like that was a, wow.
Yeah. I don't know. I was flabbergasted when she got taken out of our family. I mean, we were, you know, here, my mom was working with her, you know, 8 hours a day, and my brother was getting neglected and I was getting neglected, and it ruined my brother's life. This whole thing ruined his life because my dad was under a lot of stress. My dad started scapegoating him, and he was, you know, his behavior just got worse and worse as he got scolded and punished more and more. So he basically became an abused child. And it was all the ramifications of this kind of kept rolling. My mother became quite ill. She became an invalid for about 5 years. She was in and out of bed for a year and a half. She was in bed, and I was taking care of the family and doing the cooking when I was 13. So wow. So I had a lot of responsibility and loved being with kids. It's like my parents were, you know, working really hard and full of stress. So my brothers and my sisters, my later sister, were so much fun to be with. And I just loved being with them. They were the light of my life. And I became very close to my family, and I was not very dependent on my friends outside my family. I really poured my energy into our family for my whole teenage years, really. I have a few very strong friendships, but friends couldn't hold a candle to what was going on at home and where, when did I need to be home? Who did I need to help? How did I need to help them? So, yeah, I kind of slid right into the helper role
at 13,
still stuck there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, my mom she was the oldest of 12 kids. So I noticed a certain, and Ronnie, my wife, is also the oldest of, you know, 4 kids. And I've often noticed, of course, the role it kind of becomes an archetype almost of the oldest child who feels responsible for the younger ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I found something that helped me as a parent, I mean, I'd seen my brother go downhill. I mean, he barely got out of being a teenager without becoming delinquent. He was so badly treated at home. And I just thought, man, if there's something that helps parents, that I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it as big as I can. So it just, I don't know, it feels to me like what I get to do, leading an organization that, you know, builds support for parents and gives them good information, is if I could have chosen something at the age of 6, you know, to be involved in and to do, that's exactly what I would have chosen. So.
Like when you said the word organization, I had this image that you are also hand in hand parenting the people that you work with. Like there's that kind of love and nurture and care.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. We have, I think it's now up to 160 or 170 teachers in 17 different countries, I'm in charge of teacher training at Hand in Hand, but I don't do anything alone anymore. Matter of fact, I do less and less, and there's other really good leaders, but we all basically, we listen to parents with warmth and respect, knowing that they have done absolutely the best they could at every single moment, even when they were going nuts and doing things they regretted. that was really the best they could come up with, given their hurts and their background and the deficiencies there, the things that hadn't been modeled for them, the emotions they haven't had a chance to unload. So that is what we do. You know, we really listen to parents and get parents listening to one another so that every parent can build an emotional support system for this very important work, which is so poorly supported.
Would you say that the people that work in the organization have to do a lot of healing in their own childhood traumas before they can engage with other people, parents in this case, and other children?
It is a requirement of the people who teach that they be able to do deep work, that they have that they've built a good emotional support system, and that they be able to treat parents with respect, and that they be devoted to learning, that they be able to say, if somebody, a parent asks them a question and they don't really know what to say, that they will be able to say, I don't know, I'll find out and I'll get back to you. I mean, there needs to be honesty and transparency in everything that we do. And every time we gather parents, if it's a small enough group, every parent gets listened to, and we take listening time as well, so that we're working on our own difficulties, the places that we can't go yet that we want to be able to go and flex and be generous. So we don't stand above anybody. We're working, you know, if I'm leading a group, I take a turn that's as long as everybody else's.
I've been in meetings together with Patty because I've been, you know, working with them for some years now. And we've had meetings where if someone just has an emotional time, that becomes the most important thing for us to be with at that moment. And whatever the content of the meeting was is then put to the side until we get grounded again.
Yeah. And we, you know, you do that in a conference like that because people don't have this opportunity other places. In our practice, we all have two or three listening partnerships, people that we listen to and they listen to us, you know, weekly or, you know, often. And so we park our emotional work in places where, you know, someone is ready to listen, and then we're going to pay them back with time. So in my workshops, we wouldn't stop everything for that. We would do a demonstration, you know, sort of give a person a while to work on this so that they have good access to the feelings. And then everybody goes off to work on their feelings, and they have their listening partners so that it doesn't stop the flow. It's part of the learning process. Like, for instance, we had a staff meeting, a board committee meeting in which our administrative director was there, and she's got a son at home who's trying to do remote learning, and he just doesn't do well with it. And she'd had a really hard week. And, you know, we just sort of looked at her and said, how would you like some listening time? And she got some listening time, and she's, you know, she totally deserves it. And it's the thing that's going to let her think in the meeting. So yeah, it's a value.
So you'll do this within hand-in-hand parenting as a functioning kind of value. I would use the principle gained from you and apply it in a corporate world. Mm-hmm. And my reasoning is pretty simple, is that anything that's done where the person isn't connected to their emotions doesn't have a high likelihood of succeeding anyways. So why wouldn't I take the time to ground the individual? And the group, by the way, because one individual showing their emotions tends to connect most other people to their emotions as well, because we all have the emotions if they're as raw as that one individual is something else. So I really see that this approach, let's say, is very, very successful when able to be applied, because most businesses wouldn't allow it. Because they're too determined on an outcome, and they don't think about how we get to an outcome, unfortunately. But yeah, to the degree that that is possible, I've seen it work very well in groups.
And it probably has a long-term effect, right?
Obviously. And what I, so just to add to
Sorry,
that.
Sorry, Patty.
The speed at which people achieve is higher because you've taken out like the child, you know, when we're, you were speaking to, once you've grounded the emotion, the thing that might take them 2 weeks to do can now be done in 2 hours because the emotion is now out of it. So it seems counterintuitive because you're spending time where you think now we're not getting to the outcome we want to. But in essence, the speed is actually seen in the process afterwards. That's been my experience.
When I ran an infant toddler center that had been very poorly run, I came in as the director, and I didn't teach any of the things I know about helping children heal from hurt or listening to children with respect for the first 6 months, because I just needed to take care of making sure people got their breaks, making sure they got their paychecks on time, making sure they had a, you know, just making sure there were never too many children in the center, which there had been. And the other thing I did was to have at staff meetings, which we did once a week, every person on staff got to be listened to by everybody else for 5 minutes. And you got to talk about whatever's going on in your life. And slowly but surely, because of this safe, and I just modeled respect and warmth. And thank you very much. And that's your time, you know. And at, very quickly, people began to be able to cry about the things that were hard, either with the children at the center or in their lives. And within 6 months, people felt they trusted me. When a problem came up, they could come and actually cry with me about the thing that happened. And we, you know, we could just get the feelings out of the way, and I could be helpful to them in a very direct way quite quickly, rather than them having to talk with me for a whole hour in order to establish safety. So, then we began to be able to do work with the children because they trusted me enough to go, that is such a weird experiment that we're going to listen to all this crying. You know, we've been taught to make it go away, but nothing else is working. So sure, let's try it for a week. And they would agree to do an experiment, and we'd get really good results. And then we began really being able to help the children with the most difficult problems there.
So basically, you're just a corporate coach that's hiding under the guise of children empowerment.
I'm glad I'm working with parents as parents. In a corporation, you'd be working with parents, but they wouldn't have their parent hat on, and they'd be hiding their parent hat as hard as they could.
I understand. In fact, you know what I find humorous in my own coaching is, although I don't even have children, you know, I will spend a great deal of my time coaching people with their childhood, with their problems with their kids.
And
it's following simple principles, a lot of which I've learned from you. And I think what's most fascinating is the problem that comes up most over and over again. It's always this 13 to 17 are the parents trying to deal with boundaries. And I always think it's hilarious because the boundaries they're unable to deal with in their corporate lives also bleed into their family lives. So that's the crazy of it.
Parenting is so hard and so emotionally challenging that by the time your child is 13, there's two things that go on to make that a difficult time in young people's lives. One is basically whatever age your child is, the feelings from that age in your childhood are what's coming up. And most of us had some misery in our adolescence. And so your child becomes an adolescent. They're not cute. They're growing hair in places they didn't have hair before. And we sort of back off, and we get reminded of the miseries that came up for us when our parents backed away from us, because we were reminding them of their even more miserable childhood. And so there's a triggering thing that happens there that is just happens to almost everybody. And the second thing is that parents have been through 12 years of parenting with such poor support. I mean, with 1/8 of the support that any parent really actually needs in order to have fun with parenting, and you're just tired. You're tired, and you just wish they were grown and gone already. And you don't want to wish that, and you don't even let yourself know you're wishing that. But in there, you need some respite, and there is no respite now. And so it just, I don't know. I have great compassion for parents of teens, and what we do is, you know, listen to them, and they get to cry about all the stuff that happened that they couldn't prevent, that they feel really sad and bad about. And even if they're angry with their kid, that's usually what's under the surface. I think there's a question here. Should we look at it?
Yeah, it was Bola Long.
Oh, okay.
He was saying that I have a very sweet boy, and he at times would wake up banging his head like Andy did. I thought he would be an adult with temper, but it disappeared, and I don't know what it was.
Yeah. And you can't know. You could always ask him, what do you think was going on? And he might explore around and think, what was life like then? And what did he feel about it? And maybe come up with the location of the tension like Andy did.
You know, I think part of the tension and what I recall is fear of existential fear. Mm-hmm. Or in those years, I started having fear of like, where do I go when I die? Mm-hmm. And I remember that fear was so deep inside of me that there would be coping mechanisms as well to work out the energy that came into me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've even heard that from people that I've been working with, that their children have had very, very deep existential fear at, say, the 13 or 14-year-old range.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even more so now, because the things that are going on in the world are overwhelming. Yeah.
It's hard. I have a curious question, Patty.
Sure.
And it goes somewhere else. We had someone in the show that did theater. And through the theater in the school, she could discover when children were sexually abused, for example.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, have you had that kind of experience, like doing hand-in-hand parenting, where you find that the child has undergone some level of abuse?
Yeah.
Yes. I have worked with children who I knew before I met them had undergone sexual abuse. Their parents told me.
Okay.
And we have a couple of instructors who have children, actually more than a couple, who were sexually abused outside the home. And we have some instructors who were very badly sexually abused in their own childhood. So we have experience with this at many levels. Mm. And in general, I mean, I don't know, what more do you want to ask?
Continue on it, if I may, from yours. So this woman, Regina was her name, and she actually did a puppet show. And she'd go to school, and they'd have a police officer and four people on site, because as they did the puppet show, the children would emote, and through the emote, you would actually quickly see who was being abused.
Mm.
So it was a really, I've often been almost scared when I heard her explain it, because I thought the intensity of being in such an environment feels just overwhelming, you know. And so I guess as Bambos asked you the question, I had the same question: is, are there times when the child, from your feeling, you can't be sure, you'd say, wow, I really sense there's something bigger going on here. And they're almost in like the, I would almost call the helplessness of how to deal with that situation, because in some ways, you know, she set it up so that it could be dealt with, but you're interacting, maybe just they're coming to you for support. So how do you deal with it if it happens? And yeah.
We usually, parents come to us asking about things that go on when their child plays. Basically, we get parents doing special time with their child. Mm-hmm. So I've got 15 minutes. I'll play whatever you want to play. What do you want to play? And if a child has been sexually abused, they will use, you know, they will use special time like any child would for a while. And as you pour in your interest and your willingness to be with them, whatever it is they choose, the level of emotional safety rises. And it might be a month. It might be 2 months. It might be, 5 minutes, but they will then turn to play that gives you clues that they've been sexually abused.
Yeah.
You know, they will want to do things to you that were done to them, or they will do things to dollies or to teddy bears or whatever, or sometimes the clues are not so stark. You know, all of a sudden you do special time and they look at you and they go, no, don't touch me, you know. And you weren't going to do anything, but all of a sudden this huge fear of being touched comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like all you have to do is give a child special time and be willing to play, and or they will ask you questions or use language that you know they didn't pick up from you. And lately, pornography has become this giant worldwide industry, and it's everywhere. And they, you know, the pornography industry is directly and intentionally targeting children, and pornography that is out there for them to see the minute they get online. It's very misogynist. It's very disrespectful and violent. It's not just, you know, this is how we do it. It's like, this is how we dehumanize women while we do it. We dehumanize people. And so there is more and more of children, you know, sort of using language and showing behavior that comes from what they've seen on the internet that has really damaged their minds, and they're trying to work it through.
What I love about what you've said is that by creating the safe space, the messages will appear.
That's right.
If there's no space, everything is random and you don't understand or see, but by creating the safety, then the signals will become more apparent, and especially over time, I'm guessing.
And this is true of children of any age. I remember long ago, I was working with a dad who was doing, they had to put their 14 months or 15 months, just had a few words and nothing more. They brought a nanny in, and he's going, well, how do I know that my child is safe with this nanny? I just don't know if this is a good person, or they look like a good person, but you don't really know what they're doing. And I said, well, really, all you need to do is special time with your daughter. Just do special time, you know, at least 5 minutes every day. And if there's something weird going on, you know, you will find out. And within the first week or two that he started doing special time, she, you know, sort of motioned to him and pulled his hand and made him sit down next to her, you know, pointing to the ground. And then she slapped his knee and said, bad, you know. And they had never slapped her at all. And she did it two or three times, bad, bad. And and I said, well, you know, if she's not watching TV and you have never slapped her, then that word and that attitude and that, you know, that behavior came from, you know, the person who's taking care of her. Mm-hmm. And children will let you know.
Something that I've often found fun and interesting and playful in the hand-in-hand kind of curriculum is that I've never seen hand-in-hand as parents with kids. I've always seen it as parents creating ground rules of how they want to raise their kids. Because in my mind, and keep in mind, I'm outside, so I'm looking outside in. I'm not in the middle of it. But I mean, one of the biggest challenges I've found in counseling parents that are together is when they have different values around how they want to raise their kids.
Yeah.
And then the fight between the parents now becomes the problem of the child because they can't agree to sort of how we're going to navigate raising.
Yeah, we've got a couple articles on our website just giving some direction, because there are no two parents who do things the same way or carry the same values, and there's no one parent who does it right all the time, even by their own estimate. It's like we all wig out and are hard with our kids, and we all wig out and lose our patience. It's way too hard a job for any kind of perfection to appear. And the other thing that's interesting is that parents in general are pretty badly disrespected in society. There is an aspect of oppression around parenting, and one of the ways you can see it is you walk down the street, your child has a tantrum, and people are going to shoot daggers at you through their eyes, or they're going to tell you, you know, just give them a swat on the butt. What's the matter with you? I mean, they'll tell you what to do. They'll criticize you. You know, your mother-in-law will come over and tell you all the wrong things that you're doing, never a right thing. And just the freedom with which people criticize a parent hard at work is total. It's total. Yeah. And so what happens is that we internalize, I'm a bad parent, or I have to be, you know, I have to defend myself against others. And then when you're at home, what happens when you're oppressed is you aim the oppression at people who are oppressed the same way you are. And that's what makes the women's movement hard, is because it's hard for women to support a woman leader because they feel bad about themselves, you know, around leadership. And it's hard for people of color to support one another in one ethnic group because the internal messages of, you know, we are bad in certain ways have been that they just aim those messages at one another. And this is why it's why we haven't got totally cooperative societies yet, is because of this internalized oppression mechanism. And so the first person that you are upset with and mad at and, you know, totally critical of is your co-partner who you really, really need and really, really love.
Yeah.
Is they're the safest person to get mad at. And they're also just the internalized oppression sort of gets you, you know, working at against them rather than supporting them to do their best thinking and appreciating how well they managed to pull out of one really angry 15-minute thing with your daughter, you know. So
I want to ask another question. Boundboss, what's going on in your head right now?
I'm just loving Patty. I was thinking, wow, she should be in politics, like hand in hand parenting the politicians. And then I thought, what do you see in Trump as a child? And I'm like being quite open about not trying to find something bad about him. But I'm curious, what kind of childhood would one have to have to be where they are today?
One would have had to have intensely manipulative parents. Intensely manipulative. You're not good unless you produce, you know, what you produce is shitty. What's the matter with you? And coldness, you know, basically parents who couldn't connect in any emotional way ever. I mean, there's probably very few shreds of warmth and kindness in his whole experience. And the other thing that has happened is that no one has set limits with that man. Okay. No one has set limits. And really, you know, what happens is if someone has a behavior pattern that is nonsensical and hard on people, if no one sets limits, that pattern gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the person is basically doing behaviors that are a cry for help. And if no one comes, the cry gets bigger and awfuler. And, you know, it winds up consuming the person. There is a little guy down there who just needed help so badly, and the behaviors are harming the world at this point. But no one, until someone sets limits, you know, nothing's going to get better.
Yeah. I was anxious about Boundboss asking you that question, and I'll tell you why. Do you know why?
You don't want politics on the show?
No. Oh, I mean, I don't mind politics. I was anxious because, you know, in some ways, you're supporting parents, but maybe half of those parents will be supporting Trump. Mm-hmm. And they might view the qualities we're speaking of, and you could see them in a positive light as much as one might say you could see it in the negative light. So I was anxious in the question that why would you, I was anxious that we might alienate some individuals in, you know, from, which was just my anxiety. I can own it. It's, you know,
I mean, we might, and really mostly I'm not talking politically. I'm just talking about someone who, you know, denigrates people. I mean, everybody will agree that these things have happened, or most people will agree that he denigrates people and he treats people badly. And anybody who's worked for him has been the target of, you know, his animosity. And those are all, you know, forget the policies. Those are qualities of someone who has never been treated well.
That was really what I wanted to.
I believe we live in a world where all the things you just stated as obvious that I also find obvious are not seen as obvious. So that's a sad world we're in at the moment. Part of our show is not only asking, but it's owning our own insecurities as well, so that they can be shared in the whole dialogue, right?
Yeah. Bo Lilong is asking about, what about teenagers? Can I say a little something there?
Obviously, please.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big subject. And we don't, as Hand in Hand, we don't focus. We have a little bit of a focus on adolescence, but we have a booklet called Supporting Adolescence that you can get a PDF of. It's not very expensive. And really, I think the thing that we need to know is that teenagers still need us to connect with them the way that a two-year-old needs their parent to connect.
Yeah.
But the way it takes longer for a child to feel connected as a teen than it did when they were two. So if you want to connect with a two-year-old, all you have to do is get down on your knee and say, hi, you know, and then look open and act open and have an open heart, and they will figure out what they want to do. You know, they will look at you. They will begin crying because you're not their mommy or daddy and they're scared of you. I mean, and that's a sign that there's safety there. They will bring you a toy and you can, you know, look at it, but you're thinking, I'm with you. I'm with you. And a teenager basically is having to navigate a bigger world and having to worry about how is it going to be an adult. And they also have piled up feelings of hurt that they haven't been able to work on. And those feelings create something of a wall between a teenager and their parent. And so the place to start again is special time. And with a teenager, you don't kind of walk up and say, hey, I heard this lady on the podcast today, and I want to do special time with you. It's supposed to be really good. So most teenagers will go, not, you know, it's like, if it's your good idea, I'm not doing it. You know, I'm not doing it because you want to, or because you think it's going to be good. You've had a lot of other good ideas that haven't seemed so great to me. And so often with teenagers, you want to start with unannounced special time where you just, you know, they're doing their homework or their, you know, something they're into, and you just kind of go into their room and say, hey, you know, it's warmer in here than out there. Can I sit on your bed for a little while? And you just sit there and you don't ask anything. You don't say anything. But you put your mind out towards them. It's kind of like fishing. You put a little worm on your hook, and the worm on your hook is your attention. And you throw your hook in the water. And then a very wary fish is going to swim by and look at that hook 10 times and go, nope, not biting today. I don't know what that thing is. You know, you put your hook in the water again tomorrow and the fish will go by, or maybe it won't go by. And you put your hook in the water again on, you know, the next day. And sometimes you have to put your hook in the water for a week or two. But eventually your teenager's going to turn around and say, I hate math and my teacher is really sucky, you know. And then what you have to do is go, huh, instead of, well, is that why you're getting a C minus? Now, what are we going to do about that C minus? Shall I get you a tutor? You know, you just don't want to, like, you know, send your upsets towards them in any way. You just go, huh. And if they don't say anymore, then you just, you know, so you just, you know, you set it out in your mind. I'm going to sit there for 10 minutes and I'm not going to give any direction or ask for anything or say anything. And then again, yeah, thanks. It was good to be in here with you. And then you might give them a little, you know, ruffle on the head or a little hand on the shoulder, a little kiss on the neck.
Just holding space.
Yeah.
Just holding space, not trying to solve anything, just being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very, very hard for a parent of a teenager because, boy, by the time your kid is 14, you're like, what is he ever going to be able to get a job? You know, oh my God, he doesn't have any friends, you know, or he has way too many friends. Or he doesn't, you know, he's like, his pimples all over his face. What are we going to do about those pimples? It's like just your worries. So listening partnerships, if there ever was a time when a parent needed a listening partnership, somebody to listen to their worries, listen to their regrets, listen to their frustrations, listen to the lectures they want to give their kid, that will not go anywhere because the walls will go up and the animosity will go up too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, being a parent of a teen is the time to find a listening partner and just talk about your whole history with your child. Because sometimes the issues between a teenager and their parent get started before birth, at birth, you know, when the child is 2 years old and has an accident, and then the parent is totally worried and doesn't know if their child is going to live. And of course, the child lives because they're here. But the parent is then forever worried about their child. It just sets in a worry that never leaves, because the parent never doesn't have anybody to listen to all the feelings in that worry. The feelings won't go away, so they keep attaching to little pretexts. And, you know, and then your child feels worried at and criticized by all the worry. And I don't know, they can't be close to you because you're full of stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, having a listening partner is a really good idea for parents of teens. And there's a lot more to it, but I don't have time to go into the whole thing around adolescence. Handinhandparenting.org. So hand in hand parenting.
Do you ever get into situations, Patty, where parents come for help because they have a problematic child and actually they're the problem?
Actually, that happens all the
Can I rephrase the question?
Yeah.
Do you ever have a time when parents are not the problem?
Well, I think not us that are the problem. Yeah. It's basically when there's a knot between a parent and a child, you know, there's two parts to the knot. And if the child is not relaxing or undoing or changing, if they're really stuck in a behavior, then you have to be the one that unsticks yourself. You have to be the one who recovers from being frozen if your child is critical, or being frozen if your child, or being angry if your child becomes aggressive, or angry with your child because they have no motivation. It's like, you know, you can't help a child with having no motivation. They really need help. They're showing you they need help. But if you're locked into a bad dynamic, you have to be the one to undo your side before you have any idea of what to do that might really work with your child who does have their difficulties. So we kind of have to go first, and we have to keep on going first.
I think we have to book another hour with Patty because
I don't feel like we've asked any questions, actually.
I think we barely scraped the surface of the subject. There's so much.
You know, you have to realize when Patty, I was fascinated because when you do a live broadcast on hand-in-hand parenting, you'll have a few hundred people that watch you live just because they know you're coming on. Yeah. So I know you don't necessarily see yourself as this influencer, but in my mind, you've got 300,000 followers that are just waiting to say, how do I not screw up my kids' lives? And I think that's just fascinating and beautiful. There was one thing that I also kind of, it feels like a realization I came to much later in my life, and it was doing the last letter tour and just sitting and holding space and not ever driving it in any direction. I only was modeling the behavior that I was asking others. And it was exhausting, I must say, doing that many sessions in that period.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But what I learned from the experience was it was very much just like stay listening, giving everybody all the love and the support without any idea of that you need to be here or it should look like this in the end or you didn't do a good job. Like it was just there in love.
Yeah.
And I think as I've aged, I hear myself say over and over again, like love is enough. Love is enough, but it's hard because, of course, I'm lucky in that I'm in a place where I can say love is enough because I don't have to worry about finance and I don't have the kids. So it's like standing in this pristine place and saying, hey, love is enough, where I have the luxury of being able to say that.
And particularly in this period of time, parents are up against tremendous financial stress. They're up against, oh my God, what if I die? Who's going to take care of my kids? Or what if my kid dies? You know, will it be my fault? And oh, I can't possibly imagine. I mean, the fears are, they're real, they're present. And the sort of total uncertainty of things is, I mean, in a way, we're always, I mean, every moment, something totally new and unexpected can happen in our lives, all of our lives, but we don't live like that. We live like it's all going to be the same when we wake up in the morning.
Well, I think right now, because the pending election, everyone is like has a high amount of stress. So there's no one I'm speaking to nowadays that isn't living in this this sort of tomorrow. I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like.
And actually, what we, you know, I don't know, just around that stress, it's like, rather than trying to be a logical, you know, trying to work hard every moment of every day, be a logical person, it's good every once in a while to just go, whoa, man, you know, and just basically, I mean, trembling and perspiring helps us heal from fear. And right now we just need a lot of, oh my God, you know, and just to go into that space where we're scared and we're actually physical about it, because sitting stone, you know, sort of like a stone in your chair doesn't let you heal. It's like, if you, if you're feeling fear, you need to pound on something, you need to make noise, you need to, you know, there was one mom of four boys whose husband died, you know, when her youngest was, I think, 1 year old. And it was so hard. She was a young widow. It was so hard being a widow. There was financial stress. She kept a baseball bat by her bed. And when things were just like, you know, totally out of whack and the boys were eating each other alive, she would shut the door to her bedroom and pound on her bed with that bat until she could cry. And that was one of the smartest things I ever heard. It's like, exactly, you know, you want to be able to sweat and cry, and you want to remind yourself that you have power. You want to use your physical power, because that counters the paralysis that comes with fear. And once you've got this balance between the bad old feeling and the safety of now, you know, where you're not dead yet, when that balance is just right, you know, feelings can heal, and you can cry, or you can tremble, or you can perspire. Yeah.
Nice. Great. Thank you very much. Anyone who wants more information, they can go to handinhandparenting.org. We'll put the link down below so you can find it. And love you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay. Take care. Bye. Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye.
It's a wonderful chaos.
We like it that way.